Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, Jill Robbins tells us about a dispute in Japan over the redevelopment of historic parks and stadiums in Tokyo. Katie Weaver presents this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first,
Tokyo's governor is a major supporter of a building project that is raising concerns among sports fans, history fans, and environmentalists. Critics say the redevelopment plan for a public park that also has sports stadiums represents a conflict of interest between the parties pushing for it. Those involved include a major Tokyo builder, a religious organization, and Tokyo Governor Yuriko Koike. The dispute is the second involving Koike, who also pushed big development projects for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. The games were delayed until 2021 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. This time, the project involves a famous baseball stadium and a nearby area for another sport, rugby, in a historic public park known as Jingu Gaien. The stadiums are to be torn down and new ones put up. The project also will make way for two 200-meter-tall buildings and an area for stores. Opponents say the project shows the ties among the major actors: Koike, the developer Mitsui Fudosan, and Meiji Jingu. Meiji Jingu is a religious organization that owns much of the land to be redeveloped. Like other Tokyo governors, Koike is a member of the Meiji Jingu group of trustees. Hiromichi Iwasa is the former leader of Mitsui Fudosan. He joined Meiji Jingu's group of directors after he took over the company in 2011. He remains a director of Mitsui Fudosan. Koichi Nakano is a political scientist at Tokyo Sophia University. He told the Associated Press, or AP, that conflict of interest between businesses and policymakers rarely raises questions in Japan. The issue has received little attention in Japan's major newspapers. AP sent an email to Koike's office for comment, but received no answer. Former Prime Minister Yoshiro Mori is the 85-year-old former head of the Japan Rugby Football Union. He also was president of the Tokyo Olympic Organizing Group until he was forced to resign. Nakano and others said Mori was important to the deal. Nakano said the redevelopment of the park is a public issue. He added, at the same time, they, politicians, can claim that it is a private decision of a religious organization and the developers. He said, because Jingu Gaien is also a public park with a sports center, politicians get involved with decisions, which results in the cozy, probably collusive relationships among the insiders who are unaccountable to the public, Nakano said. The long-term project will take more than 10 years to complete, but minor building has already begun. Local people say the project is quietly being pushed through. Activists have begun legal action to stop it. The central questions being explored are: who controls public space, and does the public have a say? Another question is, have other plans been considered? Other issues include support for protecting the two existing stadiums and opposition to building close to a 66-hectare park designed 100 years ago to honor the Meiji Emperor. Opponents of the development project include sports fans, those who want to protect historical places, and environmentalists. They say Koike has the power to stop the project. Former Japanese national team rugby player Tsuyoshi Hirao said, "Those who love rugby do not want to destroy the environment in the name of sports." Hirao heads one of several online petitions opposing the redevelopment. More than 250,000 people have signed it. Hirao and others say the rugby and baseball stadiums could be renovated. And some people question the need for more tall buildings in Tokyo, especially since the pandemic has caused changes to work methods. The city has more than 50 buildings that are taller than 187 meters. Some scientists say the project could have damaging effects. They worry about the effects of removing green areas in a dense, hot city like Tokyo. Koike also pushed for development over objections from environmentalists and others before the 2020 Olympics. About 1,500 trees were cut down to build the $1.4 billion National Stadium for the Tokyo Olympics. Almost 2 years after the Games ended, the stadium is largely unused. It does not have a major occupier and could cost taxpayers a reported $15 million to keep up every year. People involved in the development for the Tokyo Games have faced accusations of illegal payments and insider deals. I'm Jill Robbins.
Healthy plants are the most important part of a growing garden. And one of the best ways to keep plants healthy is to make sure the soil's chemical pH level is correct. Every plant grows best in a specific pH level. The right pH level lets the plant take in the nutrients it needs to stay healthy and grow. Because the preferred levels are different for every plant, gardeners should learn the pH requirements for each one. For example, carnations require pH levels between 6.7 and 6.9. Many grasses need a pH of 6.3 to 6.8. Tomatoes need 6.2 to 6.8. Azaleas 4.5 to 6. And blueberries need a pH of between 4.5 and 5.5. Soil pH is the level of acidity or alkalinity of the soil, as measured on a 14-point number system. A pH of 7 is neutral. Values below 7 are acidic, and those above are alkaline. Each unit on the number system is 10 times the next value on the scale. So a pH reading of 7 is 10 times higher than a reading of 6. That means a small 1-unit difference is a lot. If the pH does not fit a plant's needs, It will not be able to take in enough nutrients. That is the case whether the nutrients are found naturally in the soil or added as fertilizer. A lack of nutrients will result in a lack of growth, discoloration, and even death. The wrong pH can also poison your plants. That is because, just as it can block needed nutrients, the wrong pH can also increase the uptake of other nutrients to the point they become poisonous. To learn the pH of your soil, use products like pH testing devices or an electronic meter. They can be found at stores that sell plants called nurseries or online. Kits usually contain a chemical colorant that is put on a small amount of soil. Users wait up to a minute or so, then compare any color changes to examples provided in the kit. Test strips change color when placed into a mixture of soil and water. And electronic meters provide a reading after they are placed into the soil, sometimes with water. Depending on where you live, you can also send a small amount of soil to a cooperative extension office, which are services tied to some universities in the U.S. They likely offer soil testing for a small cost. Cooperative extension offices provide agricultural services from experts. In the U.S., they can be found at this link. Many countries have similar services at universities. General guidelines often ask you to dig up 60 milliliters of soil from three separate areas 10 centimeters deep within the same garden bed. Then mix the soil samples to create an average. It is best to call ahead for directions. You do not have to do anything if your soil's pH falls within your plant's required levels. However, if the result is outside the required levels, your next step should be to amend the soil. Use the gardening product Elemental Sulfur to lower pH. Use ground limestone to raise it. Work the product about 20 to 30 centimeters into the soil before planting. Read the directions that come with the product to know how much to put in. Tests provided by the Cooperative Extension Office can offer expert guidance. Results from the office will arrive with advice about how much of which amendment needs to be added to meet your plant's preferred pH levels. Be sure to test each area or bed in your garden separately. It is not unusual for differences to exist, even within a small area. It is also best to carry out a pH test every 2 or 3 years, because soil conditions change and amendments get used up. I'm Katie Weaver.
Katie Weaver joins me now to talk more about this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. Hi, Katie. Good to talk with you.
Hi, Ashley. Thanks for having me on the show.
I wanted to ask you about one word we heard in the story, amendment. Some of our listeners may know that an amendment is a change to the United States Constitution. But what does amendment mean in the world of gardening?
Well, first, let's look at the verb form of the word, amend. It means to change something for the better. In gardening, to amend soil means to add material to it so that the plants grow better. These materials, or amendments, make the soil more fertile and in turn make the plants healthier.
Thanks so much for that explanation, Katie, and thank you for being on today's show.
You're welcome, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. On a cold October day in 1957, the Soviet Union launched a small satellite into orbit around the Earth. Radio Moscow made the announcement.
The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
The world's first satellite was called Sputnik 1. Sputnik was an important propaganda victory for the Soviets in the Cold War with the United States. Many people believed the nation that controlled space could win any war, and the Soviet Union had reached outer space first. The technology that launched Sputnik probably began in the late 19th century. A Russian teacher of that time, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, decided that a rocket engine could provide power for a space vehicle. In the early 1900s, another teacher, American Robert Goddard, tested the idea. He experimented with small rockets to see how high and how far they could travel. In 1923, a Romanian student in Germany, Hermann Oberth, showed how a spaceship might be built and launched to other planets. Rocket technology improved during World War II. It was used to produce flying bombs. Thousands of people in Britain and Belgium died as a result of V-1 and V-2 rocket attacks. The rockets were launched from Germany. The larger V-2 rocket had the ability to hit the United States. After the war, it became clear that the United States and the Soviet Union, allies in wartime, would become enemies in peacetime. So both countries employed German scientists to help them win the race to space. The Soviets took the first step by creating Sputnik. This satellite was about the size of a basketball. It got its power from a rocket. It orbited Earth for 3 months. Within weeks, the Soviets launched another satellite into Earth orbit, Sputnik 2. It was much bigger and heavier than Sputnik 1. It also carried a passenger, a dog named Laika. The United States joined the space race about 3 months later. It launched a satellite from Cape Canaveral in the southeastern state of Florida. The satellite was called Explorer 1. It weighed about 14 kilograms. Explorer 1 went into a higher orbit than either Sputnik, and its instruments made an important discovery. They found an area of radiation about 960 kilometers above Earth. The next major space victory belonged to the Soviets. They sent the first man into space. In April 1961, cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin was launched in the vehicle known as Vostok. He remained in space for less than 2 hours. He landed safely by parachute near a village in Russia. Less than a month later, the United States sent its first astronaut into space. He was Alan Shepard. Shepard remained in space only about 15 minutes. He did not go into Earth orbit. That flight came in February 1962 with John Glenn. By 1965, the United States and the Soviet Union were experimenting to see if humans could survive outside a spacecraft. In March, Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov became the first person to do so. A strong tether connected Leonov to the spacecraft. The tether gave him oxygen to breathe, and it permitted him to float freely at the other end. After about 10 minutes, Leonov had to return to the spacecraft. He said he regretted the decision. He was having such a good time. A little more than 2 months later, an American would walk outside his spacecraft. Astronaut Edward White had a kind of rocket gun. This gave him some control of his movements in space. Like Leonov, White was sorry when he had to return to his spacecraft. Later that year, 1965, the United States tried to have one spacecraft get very close to another spacecraft while in orbit. This was the first step in getting spacecraft to link or dock together. Docking would be necessary to land men on the moon. The plan called for a Gemini spacecraft carrying two astronauts to get close to an unmanned satellite. The attempt failed. The target satellite exploded as it separated from its main rocket. America's space agency decided to move forward. It would launch the next in its Gemini series. Then someone had an idea. Why not launch both Geminis? The second one could chase the first one instead of a satellite. Again, things did not go as planned. It took two tries to launch the second Gemini. By that time, the first one had been in orbit about 11 days. Time was running out. The astronauts on the second Gemini moved their spacecraft into higher orbits. They got closer and closer to the Gemini ahead of them. They needed to get within 600 meters to be considered successful. After all the problems on the ground, the events in space went smoothly. The two spacecraft got within one-third of a meter of each other. The astronauts had made the operation seem easy. In January 1959, the Soviets launched a series of unmanned lunar rockets. The third of these flights took pictures of the far side of the moon. This was the side no one on Earth had ever seen. The United States planned to explore the moon with its unmanned Ranger spacecraft. There were a number of failures before Ranger 7 took pictures of the moon. These pictures were made from a distance. The world did not get pictures from the surface of the moon until the Soviet Luna 9 landed there in February 1966. For the next few years, both the United States and the Soviet Union continued their exploration of the moon. Yet the question remained, which one would be the first to put a man there? In December 1968, the United States launched Apollo 8 with three astronauts. The flight proved that a spacecraft could orbit the moon and return to Earth safely. The Apollo 9 spacecraft had two vehicles. One was the command module. It could orbit the moon, but could not land on it. The other was the lunar module. On a flight to the moon, it would separate from the command module and land on the moon's surface. Apollo 10 astronauts unlinked the lunar module and flew it close to the moon's surface. After those flights, everything was ready.
12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
On July 16th, 1969, three American astronauts lifted off in Apollo 11. On the 20th, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin entered the lunar module called the Eagle. Michael Collins remained in the command module, the Columbia. The two vehicles separated.
25 feet. That's looking good. Down a half.
It was a dangerous time. The Eagle could crash, or it could fall over after it landed. That meant the astronauts would die on the moon. Millions of people watched on television or listened on the radio. They waited for Armstrong's message.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Eagle has landed. Then they waited again. It took the astronauts more than 3 hours to complete the preparations needed to leave the lunar module. Finally, the door opened. Neil Armstrong climbed down first. He put one foot on the moon, then the other foot, and then came his words from so far away.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Man on the moon. Oh, boy. Boy.
CBS television newsman Walter Cronkite shared the excitement that he and so many people felt as man first walked on the surface of the moon. Later, Cronkite would remember the historical significance of that moment in 1969.
It was hard, I think, to imagine our emotions at the moment. It really was something that had to grip you. It was as if you could have stood at the dock and waved goodbye to Columbus. You knew darn good and well that this was the real history in the making.
Armstrong walked around. Soon, Aldrin joined him.
They're setting up the flag now.
The two men placed an American flag on the surface of the moon. They also collected moon rocks and soil. When it was time to leave, they returned to the Eagle and guided it safely away. They reunited with the Columbia and headed for home. The United States had won the race to the moon.
The thing that made this one particularly gripping was that was that sense of history that if this was successful, this was a date that was going to be in all of the history books from time evermore. I think we sensed that at the time, just sitting there at the Cape and watching that great beast get on its way, that this was it.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.